The next year, Claude and I had to go to Lapine to school. Dad had to drive us there every morning and then come back in the afternoon to pick us up. That amounted to 56 miles a day for those two trips. It took time from Dad's work, but it was a sacrifice that my family made to see that we got our education. The school was from the first grade clear through your senior year of high school. It was two stories high, including a large basement and gym. It is gone now. It lasted until about 1992, when a big snowstorm dumped a lot of snow on the roof and it caved in. It hadn't been used as a school for a long time. Claude was, by then, a sophomore. And the little school on the ranch couldn't handle all the classes he needed for high school. I was in the third grade, in a room with both third and fourth grade. Our teacher was Miss Olin, and she lived with her father, just a block or so from the school. She was a very pretty redhead, and I suppose she married in later years. After the fourth grade, I went to a class of both fifth and sixth grades in one room. I had a wonderful teacher, Mrs. Howard. She was an older lady and always smiled a lot. We had a lot of fun in those classes because there were only 15 or so kids in a class, and we learned a lot. Claude was across the hall in the high school room with freshmen, sophomores, juniors, and seniors, all in one room. I think his teacher was Mrs. Rose. Anyway, when he graduated from Lapine in 1940, he was only 16 years old. He had started to school when he was 5 years old and took the fourth and fifth grades together back in that little schoolhouse on the ranch. Since Claude was only 16, he decided to take a postgraduate course at Bend High School. So I started my seventh grade at Allen School, which is where the Safeway store is now on 3rd Street in Bend. This was the year 1941 and 42. It burned down a few years later. My sister, Mary Jean, started at Reed School, which is now the Bend Historical Museum building. Claude drove us every day and dropped me off at Allen's school and then picked me up after school and back to the ranch we went. By the way, Claude also drove us to Lapine the last year or so, and that was fun. We drove an old Model T Ford, and the radiator was really a mess. Lots of holes, so we would fill it with cornmeal. And that would fill those holes a little, but finally the radiator would boil over and blow back into the windshield. What a mess! But Claude would fix it some way, and off we would go to school. We sometimes got to drive the better car, or sometimes Dad would drive us to Lapine. I look back now and think of the sacrifice that my mother and Dad made of going to Lapine every day. While I was at Allen School, I worked in the principal's office every day for an hour to help the secretary. I filed all the excuses that the mothers wrote to the school as to why their kids didn't make it the previous day or so. I thought it was a lot of fun, and I read some pretty funny excuses. One asked that the excuser son, because his big toe hurt. I thought that was hysterical. I don't think we would have gotten away with that. I had three or four teachers in that school, whereas I had only one previously. One of my favorites was a friend of our family, Cornelius Aloysius Patrick Mahoney. They called him Connie, and he and the gym teacher, Dorothy Slusher, went together and finally married in later years. I saw him in 1992 in Bend, and we had a good chat. His mother once taught at the little schoolhouse on the ranch, which I didn't know. When I started looking up the history of the ranch, I found some of these facts as to who taught there. I still have friends who went to the old Allen School. Also, Dad or Claude was driving us to Bend every day to school. This amounted to 72 miles a day just to get that education. By the 1942-43 era, I was in the 8th grade at the Bend High School. It was, and still is, located just 2 blocks from downtown Bend. It was right across from the Deschutes County Library, too. And as I am writing this, there is a new library being built just a block from that one that I went to so many times. This was such a big school compared to where I'd gone before. For each class, we went to a different room. It was 2 stories high, plus a basement. It had a huge gymnasium right next door where we had all of our gym classes. It had a swimming pool that we got to use some of the time. As 8th graders, we were low men on the totem pole. Everybody took advantage of us, but we survived to become freshmen. From my sophomore year on, as soon as I was 15 years old, I got a student's permit to drive a car to school. While Camp Abbott was there, I got to drive a Jeep out on our field, and all I remember was how hard it was to steer. There was no power steering in those days. You just pulled on the wheel and hoped for the best. Since we lived 18 miles from Bend, it was cheaper for the school district to buy a car for us to use. In other words, a school bus would have had to come to the ranch 18 miles each morning just to pick my sister and me up, take us into Bend, and then bring us home after school. That would have been 72 miles a day for a big school bus, and it wouldn't have been good on a business basis. I got my first special license and thought it was great fun to drive. I had a really nice 1940 four-door Chevrolet sedan with a stick shift, of course. I knew how to drive the old type shift in the floor of the cars, but this had the stick on the wheel, which was neat. My driver's license restricted me to just driving directly to the high school and back. On the back of the license, it said, "Proceed east to Highway 97, proceed to Bend City Limits, proceed to Franklin Avenue, proceed to Bond Street, turn left and drive to the school and park. Return by the same route." I never stayed within these restrictions. I was all over the place. Those were the World War II years, so our speed limit was 35 miles an hour. Ha! Sometimes I stayed in that limit. I also had a C stamp for gas, which meant I could have all I needed. I was considered a school bus. Other people that just drove to work or around town got only A stamps, which I think were either 3 or 5 gallons of gas a week and was used for personal use. A B stamp gave you more, and it was for business use, but I have forgotten how much. I think Dad was allowed a B stamp for having a ranch, which I suppose was considered a business. It certainly was a business, and I remember that he bought a 50-gallon barrel of gas that was delivered to the ranch so that he didn't have to drive to Bend for a fill-up. The whole idea was to use less of everything in those days. So here I was, driving to school at the age of 15, and I never knew until I went back to my 20th class reunion that I was the envy of all the boys in the school. Most of them had no cars, and those that did only had an A stamp, which didn't take you very far. I was allowed to stay in Bend once in a while, overnight, with a girlfriend, usually because of a football game. I then took all the kids home afterwards in my car, and I guess they still remember that to this day. I just thought it was great fun. Dad and I had a deal about it all. If I decided to come home after the game, I had to be back by 11:30 p.m., or he would start to worry. If I wasn't home by midnight, I knew he would be terribly worried, so I always tried to make it before 11:30, and I don't ever remember him yelling at me for being late. He gave me a lot of room in those days. I graduated from Bend High in May of 1947 and had many friends over the years that I see to this day. We were all very close, and we took care of each other. World War II started in December 1941. The Japanese had struck Pearl Harbor, and it was a terrible shock to the whole world. Life at the ranch changed a great deal after that time. In 1941, I believe, was the last summer that Uncle Bush and Aunt Martha came out, until after the war in 1947. All travel was restricted because of the war effort, and we went on a lot of rationing. The worst thing that happened to our family at the ranch was that we lost our mother in November of 1942. She was 42 years old and was to have a baby in January of 1943. She hadn't felt well for a couple of days and asked me to stay home and clean her bedroom on a Monday, November 2nd, which I did. That night, about 11:30 p.m., she went into a coma, and Dad called Uncle Doc to come right out. He arrived in about 25 minutes. I stayed with Mom while Dad cranked up the Kohler electric plant for lights. She kept asking for me and didn't know me when I tried to tell her I was right there. I was 13 years old and had never really been around someone that ill. I rubbed her arms for her as she said that she felt numb. Then Uncle Doc got there and took one look at her and called Ben for an ambulance. He had me go out to the dining room with him, and he asked me to stay at the stove and heat some water to boiling, put a hypodermic needle in it, and let it boil for a few minutes. I did that, and he went back to Mom. The next thing I knew, the ambulance was there, and I peeked out in time to see her wheeled out of her bedroom and he be put into the ambulance and taken away. That was the last time I ever saw her. I knew she would be okay when she got to the hospital. I went to school the next morning, and my Aunt Mittie came back to the ranch with Dad to help out. When I came home that night, Dad said that he would be going back to see Mom and that she was pretty sick. I understood that and went to bed. The next morning, Dad took Mary and me to school. About 1 o'clock in the afternoon, when I was going from study hall to the library upstairs at school, I got a real funny feeling like something was wrong. I didn't know what to think. I knew that my mom would be fine as she was in the hospital, and that is where people get better. My brother Claude, who had been away in Corvallis at Oregon State College, met me after school with Mary Jean. He also had my Uncle Charlie, who was my mother's brother from Portland, in the car. I was so excited to see Uncle Charlie, and I remember asking him if he knew our mom was ill and in the hospital. He didn't turn around and seem so quiet. Well, then Claude was the one to reach across the back seat and put his arm around me and say to me, "You're a big girl now, aren't you?" Of course, I said yes. Then he told me that our mother had died that day about 1 p.m., and I've always wondered later if that was why I had such a strange feeling at school that day at just about that time. Well, I just plain didn't believe it, but something told me I had to act sad, so that is just what I did. I tried to cry. I put on quite an act and really did feel badly for Claude and Uncle Charlie, as I felt they really thought they were correct. They took me over to Uncle Doc's house, and that is where I found my dad sitting in the living room. His face looked so sad, and I told him I would take care of him. He told me that there was a baby who had been born on November 3rd, the day before Mom died, and they didn't know as he wasn't due for a long time. He was a 7 months baby. They didn't have a lot of chance in that day. That night, I heard my dad cry for the first time, and it is etched in my memory. It was so deep and sorrowful, and I began to suspect something was terribly wrong. Why else would he cry? The next day, Thursday, I went to school, and even on the day of the funeral, Friday. The family thought I shouldn't go to the funeral due to my age. How I wished they had let me. I needed to know that she was really gone. That Friday night, some of my aunts came back to the ranch and we carried on. It took a week for me to finally reconcile myself that she was really, really gone. I just couldn't believe it. I was 13 years old, and I think I turned into a real nasty little girl for a while. I didn't want anyone to do anything for my dad. I wanted to do it all, as I was so sure I could take my mother's place. I didn't want anyone else to iron his clothes or to serve him dinner. Can you believe what a little character I was? Well, I was bad and even worse at times. In later years, I apologized to my Aunt Mittie for being such a brat, but she said she didn't remember it that way. Well, I knew I had been bad, and at least I eased my conscience a bit. She was a wonderful person who tried hard to take care of our family, which she did. As in everything else, time begins to heal when you are busy. But there were so many times I wished I could hug my mom and tell her how much she meant to me. You only have one mother, and I was so blessed with mine. She was a real saint, and anyone who knew her loved her. Many of my old friends tell me to this day how they loved her, as did all the family. I just wish she could have known her grandkids. She and I made a pact when I was 10 years old. We decided that neither of us would ever smoke. I said that if she started smoking, I would leave home, and if I started to, she could leave home. It was just a joke, but somehow I never forgot it. Maybe it is what kept me from it, maybe not. I did try once and thought it was awful. All I wanted to do was brush my teeth. That was the end of that trial. When I was in grade school in La Pine, my mother drove me to my piano teacher twice a month for lessons. Her name was Mrs. Chamberlain, and it cost 50 cents a lesson. It was quite a sacrifice in those days, and I have to admit that I did not become a piano player. I just didn't take to it. Now I look back and wonder why I didn't try harder. I envy anyone who can play a piano. This is one of my true regrets. In later years, I was told by many people that my dad and mother were the two most in love people they had ever known. My brother and I have talked about that and agree that only one time did we ever hear what might have been considered an argument. It had to do with Claude and me getting at each other over some darn thing, and one thought he was to blame and the other thought I was to blame. It lasted all of 5 minutes, if that long, but it was the first time I ever heard a difference of opinion between them. I was so naive that it was a shock when in later years I found out that married people had arguments and fights. It sure didn't happen in our house. I have a lot of their letters before they were married, and they show the love that was between these two people. That little baby, born the day before our mom died, was still getting stronger all the time. We named him David Edward, and he stayed in the hospital until February of 1943. Then my Aunt Mittie came to live with us, and she helped take care of that little boy, a lady who had never been married and hadn't been around many children, but she took over and really made a home for us. She stayed with us through the summer of 1943, and then we took Dave to Portland to stay with our cousin Elizabeth, who had just adopted a little boy the same age. She kept Dave until the following spring. I got to go visit him once. Claude and I went over in the spring after school was out and brought him back home. By then, it was 1944. We took care of him that summer, and then we took him to Bend to a friend whose husband was in the service. Her name was Connie Tyson, and she had two little girls. She kept Dave that winter, and Mary and I moved in with her. That was nice, as we could all be together while we went to school. The following year, Aunt Dorothy took Dave with them to Tumalo, and after that winter, about 1946, Dave was able to stay at the ranch. He started a school at the little schoolhouse, and there were a few other kids there with him. To me, what is so remarkable is how he turned out to be such a wonderful man. He had been around so many people, most of who loved him dearly, but really didn't get settled down in a home until he was 5 years old or so. I so wanted to quit school and take care of him, but Dad wouldn't have it. Said education was too important. So, like in Dad's day, we made do as best we could. Dad did what was best for all of us at that time. He kept us together, as some of the family offered to take each of us to help out. He felt we could manage, and somehow, with loads of help from that family of Dad's and Mom's, we did. I have never ceased to be amazed and thankful that he kept us together at that awful time in his life. World War II. I have told you before that World War II started in December of 1941. It was a time of gas rationing, sugar rationing, cigarette shortages, tire shortages, and even clothing. Shoes were scarce and hosiery was almost impossible to get for the women who worked in offices. You heard about some coming to the Weddell's department store and you had to go line up to get two pair. The nylon was needed for the war effort. I helped sign people up for sugar rationing cards, and when I was 15 years old, I got to give my blood every 6 weeks or so at the blood bank. I had to have Dad sign a special paper to give permission for that. I also had what was called a victory garden that was next to the large garden that Dad put in every year just across the big bridge. It had been set up so that everyone would get interested in growing their own vegetables. And in that way, more could be sent to our troops. I think a group of people came from the Home Extension Agency out of Redmond and judged my garden. It was all quite exciting. They looked at what was planted, carrots, beets, onions, turnips, spinach, and other root vegetables, and they gave me a blue ribbon for myself. That meant a lot. I really felt I was helping our soldiers. Another thing we did in those first war years was to become plane spotters for the government. This meant that every time an airplane came within a view of the ranch, we would go out and check which direction it was coming from, where it was headed, and what the body of the airplane looked like to see if we could identify what kind it was. Then we would call Redmond at the center of all this in Central Oregon and report what we had seen. They would have other spotters along the way that would continue to phone in when it was seen. I never did find out if there were any enemy planes that we called in. I doubt it very much, but it made us feel like we were, again, helping the war effort. We also saved tin foil that we would get from gum and other packages, roll it into a ball and take it to Ben and drop it off someplace where they collected it, again for the war effort. Camp Abbott. In 1942, Camp Abbott was built where Sun River is now. It was an Army engineering camp, and at one time it had 10,000 soldiers there. They basically learned to build things, and bridges were the most important. Claude reminded me that those engineers at Camp Abbott were the ones that rebuilt the bridges to allow American troops to enter Germany. This would have been in the 1944 and 45. They also learned their artillery prowess, as we could hear the guns at the ranch going off all the time. They shot the big shells from one side of the river to the lowlands across the river, right where we normally would have had our cattle. We found the trees shot up in later years. Dad had sold the cattle when the war started. There was also the Women's Army Corps stationed there, too. They were called WACS, and I thought their uniforms were not very feminine. We could go down to Camp Abbott for special parades and so forth, so we got to see the soldiers march and see all the barracks buildings that had been built in just a short time. There was a huge hospital unit there, and Aunt Dorothy worked there until the war was over. It was one long building with wings off the main floor and just ran forever. I got to go through it once before it was torn down after the war. We watched the officers' club go up and all those logs and that huge fireplace. It was quite something to see in those days. We heard that the colonel wouldn't give any of the soldiers working on it any leave until it was finished. It stands today as the only building left of the original buildings during those war years. It is now called the Great Hall and is a central part of the Sun River Complex. It was recently refurbished, and the lighting is much better now. It still looks wonderful. Meetings were held there, and the place is always in use for seminars and many dinner parties and other recreational activities. I believe a church service is held there, too. The rest of the buildings of Camp Abbott were all torn down and taken away. Also, I almost forgot, there were Italian prisoners of war who were brought there during the war after Italy was captured. Dad always felt sorry for them as he drove by their camp. They had their camp right close to the bridge on the south end of Sun River. I know they were treated okay while they were there. Dad said they were and that they were well fed. It was probably better than being back in Italy at the time. Dad was a civilian guard for the Army when they dismantled Camp Abbott. He sometimes worked all night, and I know one of his jobs then was to drive around the perimeter of the camp and check to see that nothing was getting in that shouldn't. If he worked during the day, we took his lunch down to him and stayed with him for a couple hours. He had a regular uniform and hat, and we kept his uniform clean and ironed, so he really looked wonderful. I think he enjoyed a lot of that time as he saw a lot of people coming and going. Some would stop and visit with him, and he got a regular paycheck. I don't know what kind of money he made, but I'm sure it was fairly good pay at the time. While the war was on, there were also a lot of soldiers right outside the fence at the ranch. They had maneuvers, and a group would come in for just a few days, practice whatever they did, and leave, and another group would come. I remember that they had tank chases. They actually ran up and down the road between Thousand Trails and where Sun River is now and chased each other. It was so noisy, and I had to stay clear away from the road at that time. The dust was terrible, but I suppose it was a lot worse in those hot tanks. I remember that a soldier was run over and killed out east of Pilot Butte. He had been sleeping behind a log and was unaware that the tanks were out chasing, and we all felt very bad about that. The men who were there for that training usually stayed for anywhere from a couple of weeks to several months. Then they were sent away overseas, and they were the ones that built the bridges in the European theater of the war, especially in France and Germany. It helped win the war. Claude said that this was the 4th Corps that came to Central Oregon, and that there were 100,000 troops there at one time. Because those groups would come and go every few days, they buried all the foodstuffs that they had on hand so they could order another batch for the next group of soldiers coming in. Dad found out about that and said, "Don't bury that stuff." So they would bring us tins of meat and cheese, and we would take it to people who needed it. They also buried food that had been fixed for meals but never eaten. And it was cooked in huge barrels on the cook stove. So Dad made a deal with them to have them bring it to the ranch and dump it into some barrels across the fence. Sometimes we went out to pick up the food ourselves with our truck. We had 2 barrels, I think, and they would fill them with the remains of meals such as spaghetti and meatballs, stews, and other kinds of food. We bought about 50 or 60 pigs and fed them that summer with that food. One time, there must have been several dozen hard-boiled eggs in the food, and it hadn't been peeled, and we tried to keep them from the pigs, as Dad thought it might not be good for them to eat the shells. We didn't lose any, so I guess we did okay. Dad always said the pigs ate better that summer than some of the folks he knew. Some of the things that I remember most about those years, from 1941 until the war was over in 1945, was how lonesome those soldiers were whom we saw all the time. There was only one other Army engineering camp in the USA at the time, and it was on the East Coast. So, what did the Army do but send the East Coast fellows out to Oregon and our fellows back to the East? It was the first time I had ever been around black men. They were very nice, and one day, two or three of them were hanging across our fence up by the barn, looking down at the river. So Dad asked them if they would like to come in. There were signs posted all over the perimeter of our ranch that said, "Off limits to all military personnel," and that meant no soldiers could come into camp. Dad said it was okay as long as he gave permission for them to visit. Of course they did, and then they wanted to ride the horses. Dad said they were just work horses, not for riding, but they didn't care. They asked if they could please ride them in the pasture. So Dad made a halter of rope for them, and they got on those old work horses and rode them bareback all over the upper rye field and had a ball. They just loved it. We thought it was all so funny. Some of the other soldiers came down and fished off of our big bridge. Dad made them poles from the willows and furnished them with hooks and bait, and they fished for hours. Dad knew how to treat them, as he had once been a soldier during World War I back on the East Coast in New Jersey and had been very lonesome. Dad kept me pretty restricted on the ranch when all this was going on. I could ride my horse Nellie around the fields, but wasn't allowed to go outside on the roads. One day, I rode down by the schoolhouse, and there was a soldier hanging across the fence. He asked me what my horse's name was, and I told him. I asked him what his name was, and he said, "Hoyman." I said, "Hoyman?" And he said, yeah, Hoyman. Well, I finally figured it out that it was Herman. He was just from Brooklyn, New York, and I had never heard that accent before. My dad laughed a lot when I told him about Hoyman. Another soldier by the name of Bill Moyes came to the ranch and visited lots of the time with a family. He had come from the Southwest and was around for about 2 months. When he left, he wanted me to write to him, which I did. He wrote long letters to me and once sent me a shell bracelet from the South Pacific somewhere. He stopped writing at some time, and I never knew what happened to him. I always wondered if he made it through the war. He was very likable and loved to come and have dinner with us. I just hope he got home okay after the war. This was all happening when I was between 14 and 16 years old. It was quite an experience at the time, and I have never forgotten those lonesome soldiers. In the fall, after we got the hay in, they would come down and pick up the hay we missed and stuffed it in their mattress to make it more comfortable, as they slept out in those days and it got very cold at night. I would help them pick up the hay, and I think they enjoyed talking to civilians like us. I remember when the Japanese surrendered, I was on the Oregon coast with a Crosby family. We were staying at Twin Rocks, just to the north of Tillamook. There was a blimp base in Tillamook. When the surrender came, everything broke loose. There was a big dance at the local hall, and a lot of blimp pilots came, and it was wild. I was 15 at the time, so it was all very interesting. It was also the first time I had ever seen contact lenses put in someone's eyes. The girl was in the restroom trying to put them back in, and they looked so uncomfortable. They were made to fit over the eyeball in those days, and I said, no way will I ever wear those things. And I didn't. High school in Bend. All during this time, Mary Jean and I were going to school in Bend, and I was going through the high school and Mary Jean through grade school. She and I boarded with different people in Bend during the hard part of the winter. I know I stayed with Connie Tyson, as did Mary Jean, during my sophomore year. It made it easier to attend class events and games. I was on the run all the time, I think. I know this was the year I met my first real boyfriend, Don, but we only went together for a couple months. Then we broke up over some slight with hurt feelings on both sides, but our friendship survived. A few years ago, I saw him for the first time after many, many years, and we had a lot of fun playing catch-up. He had been in the Air Force during the war, was a pilot, and came back and retired and returned to Bend. He was killed about 12 years ago by a renegade Indian family who were camped next to him in southern Oregon while he fished. They shot him in the back, and he died there. His son came down that night and found him. It was quite a story in Oregon at the time. They caught the family, and I have the whole story in my files. He left a nice family in Bend. High school was a lot of fun, and I kept real busy during those years. My best friend was Roma, and we still see each other. She lives in Idaho. We were all together all the time. I stayed with her, and she stayed with me. We were good friends with everyone, but neither one of us wanted to join a clique. We just wanted to be on our own, and we were. We had fun with everyone. We had some classes together, and we would meet for lunch, and after school if possible. I was a pretty good student, and I belonged to a number of organizations, such as Girls' Glee, Choir, and the Lava Bears paper. I was a business manager for the paper and for the annual named the Bear Tracks, so that took up a lot of time each month. First, I would go down to all the businesses in downtown Bend and ask them to give us an ad. Almost all the businesses would give us some. The cost was from 50 cents to $2. Then, after the ad ran, I had to go back and collect the money for each ad. I got out of school for the afternoon to do that with a special permission slip. I ran for the student body secretary one year and lost, but that didn't matter, for I was still into everything I enjoyed. The last part of my junior year and until January of my senior year, I went with Ray. His family lived near where Aunt Dorothy and Uncle Bill lived in Bend. His dad worked at the Brooks Scanlon Mill, and we had to pick him up at midnight when he worked nights. Ray and I were close friends, and then he went into the service. He was stationed at Fort Lewis here in Tacoma. He would get leave every 2 or 3 weeks and hitchhike to Bend for 2 or 3 days. One time, Claude and I drove to Maupin and picked him up after he called and said he could get a ride that far. After his visit, he had to go back to Fort Lewis, and if he was late, he had to mop floors. He and I had dates that were mostly going out with his gun, a .30-06, and with my .22 rifle. We would go over to Big River, up to Lapine, and any place we could find to shoot at limbs and tin cans. I shot his gun once. That was enough. It had a kick to it like a mule. I stuck with my .22 and had a great time. We went together until January of 1947. Then, because I was in my senior year, I wanted to be free to go out with friends without him worrying about it, and he agreed with me. We stayed friends, and I saw him once in Bend about 20 years ago, and we had dinner and talked over old times. I believe it was a more innocent time in those days in Bend. But I wouldn't have traded that time for anything. There were still a number of people there that I grew up with and that I see once a year at a Lapine Shevlin reunion, and we do have a great time. Most of them have come to the ranch as children with their parents and had gone to the swimming hole at the north end of the ranch to swim. Jobs. I graduated from Benton High School in May of 1947. I had had a part-time job at Montgomery Ward's after school and on weekends up until then. I made the large sum of 50 cents an hour. A friend of Claude's, Vern Larson, asked me to come and see him after graduation. He had an insurance agency, and I went to work for him and stayed about a year. Then I went to Lumberman's Insurance Agency, which is still a large agency in Bend, and worked there, typing policies. Had to put in all the details ourselves, and from there I went to Pacific Tel and Tel as a telephone operator. I loved that job, even with the crazy hours that I worked. This was the day when we only had one telephone company, and it was called Ma Bell. It also was a time when, as operators, we would have a headset on and plug into a board and sit down for our day's work. A light would come on the board, and we would plug into it and say, "Number, please." The party would just give us a number, such as 251, and we would put the other plug into that number and ring the phone manually. The phones at that time had no dial of any kind. You simply picked it up and asked the operator for your number. Also, if there was a fire emergency in town, the volunteer fireman would call in and ask us where the fire was. The board would really light up, and we had to work extra fast to give out the details to the fireman. I started out with split shifts, such as 4 hours in the morning and four in the late afternoon or evening. I finally worked up my own seniority to choose my hours, and I then worked from 6 a.m. until 3 p.m. I liked that shift. I still had a lot of the day left. I worked there 2 years. Tom McNellis. Right after I graduated, I met Tom McNellis. He was born in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, and grew up across the Delaware River in New Jersey. He had come to California and Oregon and had landed in Bend. He was working at the Fall River Fish Hatchery just past the ranch. I met him the day after my 18th birthday, July 5th, as I had gone to an air show with one of his co-workers, Glenn Garrison. The next week, Glenn called to tell me that Tom had cut his foot badly and was in the St. Charles Hospital in Bend. I laughed and said, "I'll have to go see him." And Glenn said, "Yes, you should, as he is new here and hasn't any friends nearby." So I trotted up to the hospital, couldn't remember his last name, and asked to see a fellow named Tom who had cut his foot open. They sent me back to the men's ward, and there he was with two women standing by the bed. I walked back, not knowing what to expect, and he seemed genuinely glad to see me. Turned out the two ladies were Glenn's mother and her friend who were bringing him some of the things he needed. I continued to visit with him twice a day until he was released, and then we started going together. Tom worked at the hatchery and also at Pacific Power and Light Company in Bend. He also tried working for 2 or 3 months near Shelton, Washington, at Camp Grisdale in the woods. The rain finally drove him back to Bend. Soon after that, he went to work at the Trailway Bus Depot as a ticket agent. His boss was Bill Crooks. That is where we made a lot of friends who are still in Bend to this day. We had a lot of fun times and were married in February 1950 in Klamath Falls, Oregon. We were married by a Judge Mahoney, who was the father of 12 children, 6 boys and 6 girls. We saw the pictures of them. Back in Bend, Tom's mother and sister Mary Jane were living with him at the time, so we were just one big happy family for those first few months. Then they went back to Philadelphia, and Tom and I stayed with Uncle Bill and Aunt Dorothy a couple of months while Uncle Bill recovered from some surgery. Aunt Dorothy was working at St. Charles Hospital, and I was pregnant, so it all worked out fine. I had quit my job, and after taking care of Uncle Bill, we got a small one-bedroom house on the west side of Bend. Son Tom. Tom was working for Leonard Lundgren at the time, and on April 11, 1951, our first son, Tom, was born, with my Uncle Doc doing the delivery. I also had several friends who were nurses there. One who cared for me was Ann Grunfelder. She was an old friend of the family, and she was an anesthetist for the hospital. She and her sister Emma lived a block from the hospital in an apartment. Neither was married, and they took turns at the hospital, as Emma was also an anesthetist. When I was very young, my mother would leave me with them for a couple hours when we came to town. They would let me take a real bath in a real bathtub with bubble bath. It was quite exciting. I really hated being away from my mother, but I usually was okay when I was with them. So it was wonderful having them there to urge me on with my first son. Philadelphia. Around the end of May that year, Tom came home from work one evening and said, "Let's go back to Philadelphia." After my initial shock, I said, "Okay." He wanted to finish his tool and die machinist trade that he had started in trade school. We took all our belongings to my dad at the ranch, and he left for the East Coast. I moved in with Dad and stayed there about 3 weeks. I packed all the things we would need into a large trunk from the ranch, and it was shipped ahead of us to Philadelphia. Tom got a job at Leeds and Northrop in Philly and told me to come on back. I tried to get an airplane ticket, but they were on strike. I waited and waited, and finally my dad suggested I go by train. He helped me get a roomette on the train and saw me off in Bend on the bus to the Dalles, where I caught the train that evening. Here I was with a tiny baby and leaving all I had grown up with. I spent 3 nights and 2 long days on that train. I can only remember how I just sat there watching the countryside go by and wondering what was ahead. I tried to take Tommy with me up to the dining car, but just couldn't handle the swaying of the train. I got very hungry. The porter finally saw my plight, and he actually babysat for Tommy while I was having a big dinner. I got to Chicago, and that same porter saw to it that I knew just where to go and actually watched over me until I left almost 3 hours later. I have never forgotten that kindness. I then found that on the overnight trip into Philadelphia, I could just ring a buzzer and they would bring my meal to me. That was a delight. And then the porter made up the bottom bunk for me, and I actually slept good going into Philadelphia. We arrived at 6 a.m., and Tom was there with a cab to take us home. We stayed with Aunt Margaret McKibben for a couple of weeks and then moved in with Mom McNellis and Aunt Ethel Thomas in the Abbotsford Project near East Falls. When I arrived in Philly, I felt so hot and sticky. Tom said it was the humidity. We went shopping right away so I could buy some cotton dresses to wear instead of the woolen things I'd brought from Ben. Very few people had air conditioning at that time, so cotton was a welcome relief. The first day I was in Philadelphia, Tom and I walked down Germantown Avenue to shop, and he took me into a small pub with just a counter. He asked me to look up on the wall of the pub, and that is the first time I saw a television set. It was black and white, and it had a commercial on, advertising Esklinger's beer. I have never forgotten that moment. Quite a fascinating thing to see for the first time. While we lived in Philadelphia, we got to visit a lot of historical places and also had lots of trips to New Jersey. We went over there to go swimming in the lakes. It was very hot and humid in the summers there and really cold and damp in the winter. We also had a great trip to Canada the last summer we lived there. We drove to Niagara Falls and then up to Finland Falls, Ontario, where Mom McNellis was born. We took both Mom and Aunt Ethel with us. We stayed for a few days at a lake in Algonquin Provincial Park. We fished and just relaxed and talked to the wonderful Canadian people. Then we went back across Lake Champlain into New York and down through the New England states back to Philadelphia and I always thought that Philadelphia was a beautiful city. It had the longest park within a city in the world. Except for the humid weather and the cold in the winter, I enjoyed my time there and learned there was a whole world out there a long ways from the ranch. While living in Philly, I worked at the home insurance company right across the street from Independence Hall. I rode a small bus from our apartment down to Broad and Erie Avenue. Then I rode the subway down to about 6th and Market, and from there I walked to work. I was on the 5th floor of the Public Ledger building, which was right next door to the Curtis Publishing Company. I could look out my window and see the Saturday Evening Post running off on the presses right across from us. At lunchtime, I would go over to the Independence Mall Square and eat and enjoy looking at the hall. At that time, the Bell was still inside, but now they have taken it to a mall in front. I could buy a hot pretzel with mustard and make lunch out of it. They were so big. I had good friends there and only worked about 6 months when I had to leave as I was pregnant with Mike. That summer, we drove to the Pocono Mountains in upstate Pennsylvania for a week. Son Mike. By this time, we had moved to a second-story apartment close to Temple University Hospital off Broad Street. We were living there when Mike was born on September 17, 1952. We had 5 different nationality doctors who helped me through that delivery. A Dr. Ho delivered Mike. A black doctor stayed with me through all my labor, and I have never forgotten that. We had a Jewish doctor, a German doctor, and an Italian doctor, so I was introduced to a whole new world away from Bend. Mary Jane came and took care of Tommy, and I remember that Aunt Sadie came to see us at the hospital and brought Mike a whole new outfit to wear home. Tom's father, Tom McNella Sr., died in October. He got to see 2 of his grandchildren, and I had always hoped he would be able to come to visit us in the West. I have always told people that my experience in Philadelphia was wonderful. I was terribly homesick, but I felt so privileged to have seen so many historic places that I might have missed. I loved the restaurants there. I found the Jewish delicatessens and the wonderful German bakeries, also the fabulous candies made there, and the cheesecake in Philly was to die for. It was so good. I was also introduced to scrapple, a Philly special meat that could be used for breakfast, lunch, or supper. It was inexpensive and I liked it. There were automat cafes there in those days. You could put a nickel in a slot and get a cup of coffee, and put a dime in and get a piece of pie. It was a great place to stop when in a hurry. There were also the diners, made like railroad cars all over town. We had a couple of favorites that we went to near where we lived. You could always depend on their food, always good. One other favorite thing I saw in Philly was the annual New Year's Day parade called the Mummers Parade. It consisted of just string bands, and it was wonderful. There were probably 30 to 35 bands, and we would sit through all of them parading up Broad Street. We took one trip to New York City, and to me, that was enough. We saw Grant's tomb, walked down Fifth Avenue, went up in the Empire State Building, and I found the whole place was overwhelming. I was glad to get back to Philly. This was in 1953, when the boys were still small. We decided that the following year we would go back to Oregon, so we made plans, and in the meantime, my sister Mary Jean came back and lived with us for a year. When we were ready to go back, we piled everything in the car and headed west. We stopped to see Aunt Martha and Uncle Bush in Sellersburg, Indiana, and stayed with them 2 nights. Then on we went west. We broke down in Soda Springs, Idaho, got it fixed, broke down again, got it fixed, made it to Boise, and it happened again. Some fun. Our money was running out by then, but we finally made it to Bend. I was never so glad to see a place as I was that Pilot Butte. Now I know how the pioneers felt when they were going out west. We stopped at Claude Nancy's, and then we went out to the ranch. Jeannie Josie Vandevert. While we were in Philadelphia, Dad had met Jeannie Josie of Newburgh, Oregon. She was visiting her sister-in-law at the Spring River Resort, which is just a mile from the bridge by Sun River. My sister Mary Jean was working there in a little cafe, and when Dad stopped by to see her, Mary introduced Jeannie and Dad. Well, that relationship ended up in a wonderful marriage. Both were widowed, and they lived the first winter in the old log house. Jeannie was a good sport about that, but they decided to build a new modern home. This they did in late 1953 and was where they were living when we arrived back from Philadelphia. Jeannie and I were already friends as we had talked and written to each other. She was a wonderful, giving, and caring woman, and my dad was very lucky to have found another wonderful woman for the last half of his life. After Dad died in 1975, I visited Jeannie as often as possible, and we were always great friends. Gig Harbor. Tom left for Portland to look for a job in his field as a tool and die maker machinist, and I stayed with Dad and Jeannie. I was 7 months pregnant and wanted to get settled soon. Tom called from Portland and said he was going to look in the Seattle area. Dad told him that our old friend Bill Routley was in Gig Harbor, Washington. Tom found Bill, who was working for the Puget Sound Naval Shipyard in Bremerton, and decided to try to get on. Well, he did on the day he applied. He worked for a week, came back to the ranch, picked us up, and took us to Gig Harbor. This was in the latter part of May 1954, and when we came across the Narrows Bridge, I thought it was the end of the world. Couldn't see any houses with all those trees. I soon got used to them and the beautiful area. It wasn't too different from Oregon, except it rained more and the trees were in abundance with loads of underbrush. Son John. We rented a small home near Bill and Doris Routley of Gig Harbor, and on July 15, 1954, we had John at Tacoma General Hospital in Tacoma. Dr. Bogue delivered John, and he was my doctor for my next two boys. We moved to Wana for the winter, but had seen a house that we liked in the Point Fosdick area. We finally bought that house in 1955 and moved in September. It was a wonderful big house with four bedrooms and two baths. It was like heaven after having lived in little one-bedroom rentals. Son Steve. That December 2nd, 1955, we had our number four son, Steve, and Grandma McNellis was living with us at the time. I was given a baby shower by the neighbors and had some new things to start his life. There were a lot of hand-me-downs in those days. Right after Christmas, Grandma McNellis got word that her youngest daughter, Dolores, had died. She left the next day for Philadelphia. Son Joe. We settled in to our great home, and on February 2, 1958, we had our fifth son, Joe. Dr. Bogue and also Dr. Lamming delivered him. Both were in attendance for Steve and Joe. Dr. Lamming had been in the service when we first came to Gig Harbor, so I was lucky to have two very capable doctors to take care of me. Dr. Bogue was afraid to come in to see me after Joe's birth. He thought I would be upset with having another boy. Well, I surely put his mind to rest in a hurry. Already had his name picked out. Tom and I both were happy with our boys. In future years, they have given us lots of girls to make it a little more even in the family. Their grandfather, Claude, thought they were the greatest thing since sliced bread. Of course, he felt that way about all of his grandkids. My biggest regret is that they never knew their grandmother Pearl. She would have loved them all to death. The End of an Era, 1975. This is just about the end of this story and the end of an era, but I just wanted to give you an idea of my life growing up on the Vandevert Ranch because you just don't find that type of life anymore. We had no microwaves, televisions, blenders, frozen dinners, saran wrap, foil, ballpoint pens, credit cards, and 100 other things that are too numerous to put down. And we didn't have running water, electricity, or a lot of money. But in looking back, we had the best of times and the worst of times with many changes over the years. We had colds, measles, mumps, chickenpox, and other diseases. It was a hard, tough life to keep that ranch going, and money could be scarce at times. Somehow, through perseverance, my folks kept it going and left us a heritage of hard work, loads of fun, love of family, and a life that I wouldn't have traded for anything in the world. I have always thought that I was the luckiest girl in the world to have been born when I was to the parents I had, and that they gave me the start in life that has followed me all my days. For that, I will ever be grateful. I must remember to tell you that my dad thought the Sun River development was just great. He liked what they did with the property. He helped them name the streets in Sun River and gave them general information about the area. For this, in later years, they named one of the banquet rooms in his honor. He thought that was rather special. The ranch was purchased in 1987 by Jim and Carol Gardner. Since then, Jim has been writing a book titled, I Spied a Young Cowboy, about the history of the Vandevert Ranch. Since writing this journal, Claude and I have decided that any papers of value regarding the family will be given to the High Desert Museum for safekeeping. Claude and I feel that this is the best place for all those documents, as they will be archived and taken care of for the future. Acknowledgements. I wish to thank my brother Claude for helping me with some of the facts that had eluded me and for encouraging me to keep going with the story. My friend Bert Hagen in Bend, Oregon, who was the one who inspired me to write my story long before I ever thought of doing so. A few of those with other kind words, Carol Gardner, Bob and Joanne Orr, Keith Clark, and Fred Pursley. Thank you all for taking the time to read and pushing me to go ahead. Without this extra confidence you all gave me, the book would still be unwritten. Since writing the book, I have lost a very dear friend, Bert Hagen of Bend, who encouraged me to write my story. I will never forget him. Finally, my brother Claude, Dave, and I lost our sister Mary Jean. She died March 13, 2003 in Portland, Oregon, and we will always miss her warm and caring heart. She leaves a wonderful son Danny and a daughter Mitty and all their families.